the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we talked a little bit about the Japanese crisis last week, but I've been asked several times. I was on the plane the other day and someone who wasn't even financially aware was asking, why in the world would the yen be rising during a period of time where Japan's at one of its greatest crises?
Well, Kevin, the Japanese crisis does not explain why the yen is appreciating, and there's certainly a lot of things in the background that we should cover for that to make sense. But if there's one news item that people should latch onto in the last 10 days, it would have to be the G7 intervening in the yen market to keep that market depressed and to suppress its price. They don't want it to appreciate anymore.
So, David, the G7 intervened with about $25 billion worth of yen. I mean, of course, it converts into a much higher number when you convert it to yen. But the reason still is to depress the value of this moving up yen.
And I think if you asked the average guy or gal on the street why that would be, you might say, well, they are in crisis and they need help. The last thing that the Japanese need is to lose an export advantage by their yen appreciating to the point where they're squeezed. They're no longer competitive in the marketplace with the Chinese, with the Indians, with the Malaysians, with the Indonesians in terms of finished products. Here's a problem with that, Kevin. We live in a world that is very self-centered. Everyone in the world is self-centered. And the idea that we would do things strictly on a humanitarian basis as a country or collectively, the G7, while that's nice, it's not realistic. We would hope that that would reflect the heart of man. It, in fact, is not.
Well, sure. There may be certain things that are being done out of the heart, but as far as the tens of billions that are going into this yen intervention, that's purely self-serving. Am I right?
Correct. And we'll get to that in a minute, because the bottom line issue is one in the derivatives market. And we'll talk about what could have been last week and still remains an issue of complete destabilization within the financial system.
Well, David, one of the things that we know about Japan is that their interest rates have been low for a couple of decades now. In fact, not just low, almost at zero. Don't they call that ZERP, zero interest rate policy?
That's right, Kevin. And, you know, essentially what you have in the context of zero interest rate policy there and now in the United States for nearly 2.5 years is the setting of a stage for bubbles. Mm. When you have rates that low, you misallocate capital. And you end up increasing systemic risk significantly. Now, since 2008, there's been an unwind of the yen carry trade, and we'll talk about what the carry trade is, why it's been unwinding here in a minute. But essentially, this low interest rate environment has been in place for the Japanese, certainly lower relative to the rest of the world, if not in nominal terms, since about 1989, since the stock market crack up there. Low rates, ample liquidity. You've got the debt to GDP figures in Japan, which are north of 200%.
Well, now, wait a second. Okay, so their GDP figures are half of what their debt is. Reinhardt and Rogoff actually argued that at 90%, that was a threshold that was critical to economic stability.
And the Japanese have gotten away with these high levels of debt relative to GDP for a couple of significant reasons. One stabilizing factor for the Japanese is their high domestic savings rate, much of which finds its way into government paper. It's domestically financed, which is a critical variable. Domestically financed, their debt is.
Right.
And it's in local currency terms, which is another stabilizing factor. Both of those things play to their advantage.
Okay, now, explain what you're talking about, because not all debt is domestically financed. How would that play to their advantage for the Japanese?
The difference is if they were financing that in foreign currency terms versus in yen terms, where the currency fluctuations somewhere else in the world may impact their ability to pay. They're really in control of their destiny by having, as we are in the United States, having our debt denominated in dollars. Their debt is denominated in yen. But there's something interesting that's happened to their savings rate. Historically, it's been between 10 to 20%. And over the last 5 to 7 years, it's tapered to less than 3%. Part of that is demographically driven. But there's a number of variables which are taking their historically high savings rates to lower levels. The old way of financing Japanese imbalances will, in fact, in the future, have to change.
Okay, well, that brings us to the question that we started with. How can the yen be appreciating in the context of the earthquake, the tsunami, the nuclear incident that's going on right now, so much so that for the first time in 11 years, the G7 nations are actually pumping money, yen, into the system?
Well, that's a good question. Why are we discussing savings rates? Why would we discuss debt levels in relation to Japan? What we're interested in is the carry trade. Mm. We're interested in the variables of risk within this so-called carry trade, and we're interested in the parallels between the U.S. and Japan as we now share a common monetary management style, Kevin, where we're keeping the same kind of policy in place, keeping rates low and allowing cheap money to permeate the financial system in hopes that it will, in fact, filter through the banking system and into the larger economy.
Well, Dave, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to explain in simple terms what the carry trade is, but there's something else on my mind. I mean, the Japanese are the third largest holder of U.S. treasuries. That's something that we can't really afford, a flood of dollars into the system. David, is there any chance that the Japanese will sell treasuries into the market, thus depressing the dollar even more?
Well, and the issue there is really if that's the place where they would pull money with which to rebuild from this great tragedy, both the earthquake and the tsunami.
Do you think that'll happen?
I don't, Kevin, for one very clear reason. They can't afford, for a number of reasons that we'll get into, to have their currency appreciate further or at an advanced or fast rate. And that currency appreciation would occur in the process of selling dollars and buying yen.
So it would depress the dollar, it would raise the yen versus the dollar, and it would make them non-competitive. Semiconductors, automobiles, that type of thing.
Well, and not just an issue of non-competitiveness, and we'll get to this in just a minute, but there is an acceptable amount of volatility either up or down within the currency, and that's what's been challenged. It's been appreciating too far. It's gone too far and too fast.
Okay, Dave, then that takes us back to where we said we would cover. David, that takes us back to the carry trade. What is a carry trade?
It's basically this, Kevin. You borrow a currency, assuming a low rate of interest, which is preferred. You could look at a market like Japan or the U.S. You borrow a currency, and then you sell it to buy another currency with a higher yield. So essentially what you're doing is, if I'm borrowing from the Japanese with virtually 0% interest, mm-hmm, and buying U.S. government bonds, 10-year government bonds, and collecting 3.5%, I'm going to make 3.5% on someone else's money.
Right.
I'm borrowing it virtually for free, investing it, getting the proceeds back of 3.5%, that is a carry trade. Wherever you are using someone else's money and are benefiting from it, there's a version of a carry trade.
Well, then I've also heard that these carry trades can grow much larger than the original borrowing that occurred. So, I mean, is there leverage that plays into this as well?
Typically, if you're involved in a currency carry trade like this, you will add leverage to the trade. 5 or 10 times leverage is pretty common. So, A 3.5%, let's call it 4% on borrowed money, times the 10-to-1 leverage on the trade, and with someone else's money, you can collect 40% a year.
So why isn't everybody doing it? I mean, is there a danger to this that we're starting to see unfold?
Well, sure. There's variables that you have to watch, and this is where, you know, not just anyone will participate. You have to be keenly aware of these variables, how they move and how they can impact you negatively. First of all, you've got interest rate movements, which can create fluctuations in fixed income asset values, so that interest rate fluctuations are one critical risk variable to keep an eye on.
Okay, so there's also the currency fluctuation, isn't there? That's what we're talking about, trying to keep the yen from appreciating.
Well, exactly. If the currency you originally borrowed in, I borrow in yen and then go invest in some other currency. If I borrowed in yen and that currency begins to appreciate, you have to pay back the loan
at a higher level,
at an appreciated level.
Yeah.
So equally important is the currency that you then go and invest in. You've borrowed in yen. If you go invest in dollars, what happens if that currency depreciates? So you've got the potential dual currency risk, appreciation in the currency you borrowed in, depreciation in the currency you invested in.
So we have the interest rate variable. We have the currency fluctuation variable, but these people are borrowing to go do something with that money. Is there a variable as far as the payout on the investment that they're spending that money on?
Exactly. An investor is going to assume that the asset that they've chosen to allocate capital to is a winner, and that they're betting correctly on the market. So a third variable of risk is that the investment they've chosen, the vehicle they've chosen, should be appreciating instead of depreciating. It should be going up in value instead of down.
Okay, so the yen. Has the yen been a stable currency that people could count on for this carry trade, or has it been rising or falling outside of the context of what people would expect?
Let's look at the 2008 to present, that period. As the world has made strides to deleverage and de-risk, if you will, portfolios, the funding currency of choice for the carry trade, that is the yen, at least for the last 10 years or more. And instead of yen being borrowed, sold, and the proceeds going to purchase another currency and another asset, you now have the reverse happening, where those loans are being paid back, which means that yen has to be purchased and the loans repaid.
So that's what's creating the increase in the yen?
Correct. Well, and it's been doing that since 2008. The yen has appreciated close to 40%.
Wow, 40%. Well, I thought this whole carry trade was resting on something not the original currency not appreciating. 40% is huge.
It's been a significant move. And I think what defines this period from 2008 to the present is that it's been done in modest steps. It's been done in a controlled range, and it hasn't been extreme appreciation or depreciation one way or the other. So that it's been a predictable variable for people involved in the yen carry trade. But with every uptick in the yen, you have the carry trade participants having to consider the cost of paying off their loan at that new elevated price level. So as the world cuts back on both leverage and risk, it's no surprise that the yen has been on the rise.
Okay, now, David, you're saying it's no surprise that the yen's been on the rise, but why? I mean, why did the yen tick up here over the last couple of weeks?
Kevin, there's certainly a short-term burst of demand for yen, the actual currency, in the context of the crisis. But we also are coming into the government's year-end, which is March 31st.
So the tsunami was bad timing.
It was, and it's not uncommon for corporations to match up their year-end with the government's year-end. And so you do have some repatriation of proceeds from foreign transacted business now coming back and being translated into new yen purchases.
Okay, now, David, every March is year-end for Japan. So that was an expected occurrence. That's something that they could have actually planned for. I'm going to ask you why they're intervening now, but I'd like to go back and just have you give a simple example of what a carry trade is to, say, the common man. I'm not talking about the people dealing in tens of billions of dollars, but okay. What is a carry trade on the street?
I have my own carry trade at present, and it's simply this. I've borrowed from Bank of America at 4.875% for 30 years. So I've fixed the term, I've fixed the rate, and instead of paying off my house, I've chosen to carry a certain amount of debt. And on the other side of my balance sheet, I have an asset that I'm preferring to invest in rather than pay off that debt.
What would that asset be if you don't mind sharing?
No, specifically, it's gold and silver. So I have my own version of the carry trade, and this is the hurdle. Rather than borrowing at 0%, if I were borrowing from the yen, I'm borrowing from Bank of America at just under 5.
Right.
So each year, I have to, on the asset side of my ledger, I have to see gold and silver appreciate greater than the 4.875%, or I don't have what's called a positive carry.
I see.
If I'm actually making greater than 5%, which for the last decade, in fact, gold and silver have far outperformed that number to the tune of 12 to 18%, depending on how you're figuring it. But 12 to 18% puts that 5% figure, and yes, I'm happy to carry some debt on my balance sheet, as long as I've got the asset on the other side outperforming the cash payments to service the loan.
So a carry trade isn't as complex as I think people would like to make it sound. Now, the complexities get larger when the money gets larger. This is where G7 comes in, isn't it?
Well, that's right. So you've got the expected and acceptable range of volatility. It appears that the issue is not so much the yen appreciation as it is the rate at which that appreciation has been occurring.
It's very rapid right now.
So let's call that an acceptable level of volatility. Mm-hmm. This would be sort of having an upward bound and a lower bound.
Sort of a ceiling and a floor.
Right, in which market participants are not compromised in any way, that their positions can be held. But consider the move outside of that acceptable level of volatility. What currency fluctuations or interest rate fluctuations, what I'm getting at here, Kevin, is simply this. Are there things that would trigger a credit default swap to be forced to pay? To trigger an insurance policy, what we today call a derivatives product, which is really just an insurance policy on an underlying asset, what would cause that trigger to happen?
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. So there are points where those would be triggered and have to pay off the losses.
It depends if we're talking about interest rate fluctuations, if we're talking about certain variables. You know, keep in mind, most of your derivative contracts, Kevin, are just that. They are contracts. Mm-hmm. They are not things that trade in the open market. It's two people sit down at a table, and at the end of a long week, you've got a ream probably 500 pages long, which details who's obligated to pay what and under what circumstances. And I think the issue here is this, Kevin. The G7 intervenes directly in the yen because although the yen has been appreciating for the last 3 years, it's now appreciating at a level and at a pace which is unacceptable. It's going out of that upward bound.
And so those credit default swaps were actually written with volatility that's much lower in mind.
Well, and this is just it. I mean, whether you're talking credit default swaps related to interest rates, credit default swaps, or other derivative products relating to just market volatility in general, many derivative products are used to protect against default, protect against extreme price moves, essentially insurance on the core investment. If volatility exceeds that anticipated level, Kevin, then the derivative contracts require an insurer to pay the insured. So not only do you have what we talked about earlier, Kevin, the interest rate variable, which is a risk, the currency variable, which is a risk, the investment that someone is buying on the other side of this leveraged carry trade dynamic.
Those first three variables that you're talking about, David, those are only in play when the system's working perfectly. But what you're talking about now is when the system starts breaking down from other areas.
Right. And then in the context of a carry trade, you have two new variables of risk. One is counterparty risk. And behind that counterparty risk is the liquidity and solvency of the counterparty.
Can those people who are insuring pay is the question.
Right. So you've got the insurer who sold a protection against interest rate fluctuation, just as an example, or against catastrophic loss, or against a defined volatility parameter. This begs several questions, Kevin. Does the insurer have the resources to pay when the payment on that contract is required?
Well, David, didn't we see this in 2008 with American companies like AIG?
Well, exactly. So then the next question is, how has the insurer invested the proceeds from the derivative contract? You know, are those resources even liquid? Or have they appreciated or depreciated? In other words, you've got bets behind the bets, and you're hoping that everyone has their ducks in a row. If they don't, this is where you see concerted intervention. This is where you can expect to see the G7, not just as they did on last Friday, but on any Friday, step into the market and create stability, because they can't afford for there to be an unwinding of a single bad bet that can have a cascade effect. This is the nature of the derivatives market, Kevin. This is the nature of this market where you've got a bet on a bet on a bet. If you begin to see an unwind with one bad trade, you may see a cascade effect into other financial institutions, into other asset classes. So there's a key operative word here, and we saw this in play with the G7 this last Friday. Containment is the operative word.
You know, it's amazing. I'm just listening to you, and I'm thinking of the metaphor or the allegory of what's going on in physical terms. I mean, you have not just an earthquake in Japan, then you have a devastating tsunami, but not just a devastating tsunami. You now have a nuclear crisis. I mean, it builds and it builds and it builds, but it started with a simple, I mean, granted, it was a 9.0 earthquake, but that was not the only crisis.
And you may say, well, there's really no connection between the derivatives market, perhaps to a small degree, because you have insurers and reinsurers, different kinds of insurers and reinsurers who are on the hook for property losses. We're not talking about those insurers.
This is all finance.
We're talking about just in the world of finance. Kevin, the point is simply this. There is a reason for the G7 to intervene in the currency markets. And the reason is not protecting the Japanese from an appreciating currency, because they've been allowing that since 2008.
Sure.
40% appreciation, and they're just now defending it? I mean, has it reached a critical level? Or was it, in fact, the rate at which it began to appreciate over the last week or so that has caused it to reach critical mass? It's the rate, not actually the nominal figure.
So what you're saying, it's not to keep Japan competitive, even though that's necessary by keeping the yen lower than the dollar or lower than these other currencies, but rather a much larger snowball is what we're talking about. Almost what we could have had was another financial crisis like we had in 2008, where all of a sudden you have these derivatives at risk again. And it was all based on this initial rise in the yen, the need for liquidity.
Right. If we reach a certain critical point, Kevin, it will be because we got there in a time frame which was too short for them to hedge it out, for them to create another insurance on the insurance product, a layered derivative upon a derivative. In fact, it was the rate of change which got ahead of them.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned in the past commodity indexes based in dollars. How does that play out based in yen?
Well, and this is an interesting point because it could be argued that, in fact, we have the competitiveness of Japanese products, which is in decline in the context of the yen increasing. And I think one of the things that misses is that there's also a basic discounting of input costs with that yen appreciation. Let me give you an example specifically from the commodities markets. If you look at the commodity indexes, the CRB or the CCI, in dollar terms, you've exceeded the 2008 highs by about 8%. So We're at new levels, and they've exceeded those old highs. So we've had a breakout in the commodities prices.
Commodities are rising versus the dollar.
Right. But if you put them in yen terms, you actually have an 18% discount to the peaks that we saw in 2008. So you've got us paying higher prices than we've ever paid for particular commodities, and they're still 18% below the peak priced in yen because the yen has appreciated so much during that same three-year period.
So let me take the other side of the coin then. Japan's going to have to be rebuilt. There's a whole lot of commodities that have to go into Japan to rebuild this northern tip of where the real devastation was on the island. Wouldn't it be better for them to keep a high yen so that those commodities and the lumber and the copper and everything else that's going to go into that rebuild are cheaper in yen terms?
From an economic management standpoint, you weigh the benefits of being able to buy more of those commodities cheaply in the marketplace set against your exports and how competitive they are in the marketplace. But that is not why the G7 was keeping the currency suppressed. The G7 is not trying to keep the Japanese export market alive. States are far more self-interested than that. And you're talking about six other countries, Japan being one of those seven countries, who have far more at risk than seeing Japan lose competitiveness.
Okay, now, there's a strange anomaly because out of that G7, how many of those countries actually carry surpluses? I mean, you would borrow from a country that has a surplus, would you not?
There's only two. And ironically, it's the Japanese who are one of the two that actually have a trade surplus. The only other one is Germany. Everyone else, we're bringing money to the table that frankly doesn't exist.
We're a deficit country.
$25 billion in currency intervention in a single day.
Where'd it come from?
And this is like the magic of the tooth fairy. Where'd it come from? I mean, a modern monetary policy is no different than the world of the tooth fairy, Kevin.
Okay. Now, modern monetary policy really has only been one thing. It's printing money and lowering interest rates, I mean, which are very much the same thing, is it not?
Well, true. And that's, I think, one of the things that we have, unfortunately, to look forward to, because in the present context, the U.S. has stepped in and replaced Japan as the favored carry trade lender. In other words, what are our interest rates today at the short end?
They're almost zero.
So if you look at our yield curve, our short-dated paper is 0.25%. If you're borrowing from the Fed window, you're talking about less than 0.5%. Very, very, very cheap money. You could take that to the Brazilian real and in short-dated paper, look at 11.25%. That's interesting, and you don't even have to leverage the trade.
So what you're saying is the United States is actually a pretty darn good place to borrow money right now, as long as all those variables that you talked about before don't start kicking in.
Exactly. So the stability of a dollar carry trade has everything to do with our interest rates. They need to stay low.
Right.
If they don't, that's a problem. And keep in mind, we don't fund the way the Japanese do domestically. We fund most of our debt internationally. It may be denominated in dollars, but a lot of it is held by the Japanese and the Chinese and countries throughout the Middle East. And now, of course, the new big purchaser of treasuries is the Federal Reserve itself. So I guess you could argue there is a domestic component to treasury consumption. But most of it is international, Kevin, which means that there's not as much control in terms of our interest rate environment. You could look at the Japanese and say, well, the yen has been yielding next to nothing for a very long period of time.
Right.
Why hasn't it bounced up? It has a lot to do with the fact that the primary purchaser is the Japanese people themselves. So it's a stable audience, a loyal audience, very different than when your debt is financed internationally.
Well, it's a surplus country. I mean, us being a deficit country, we can only keep interest rates so low for so long without inflation. Last week, we talked about the theme was inflation, inflation, inflation. Low interest rates and money that's coming out of thin air leads to inflation, does it not? And the second largest economy, the up-and-coming superpower, is raising interest rates right now, as we're talking about lowering interest rates and pulling out this carry trade.
Well, and specifically with reserve requirements, they bumped them another 0.5%. Mm-hmm. So they're requiring banks to keep upwards of 20% on the books, which is a pretty big deal. It lowers the leverage ratio, if you will, for the banks that are lending.
So, and is that an inflation-fighting move?
You know, essentially, it's a deleveraging of the markets move. They're trying to tame things down and calm down the markets to try to squash speculation. Meanwhile, in the U.S., as we started by saying today, Kevin, when you have a zero interest rate policy, what you're encouraging is a misallocation of capital. What you're encouraging is speculative tendencies which distort all kinds of markets. And that is, in fact, what we have in place. We're not taking on the attitude that we need to fix the world of finance and fix our economy. We're actually in a very dangerous place, Kevin. We're a very dangerous place. If you look at the last 9 recessions in the United States, all of them were immediately followed with a reduction in interest rates so that we could stimulate the economy and get back to recovery.
We had that parachute in the plane. It reminds me, you know, we've run out of parachutes and we've still got more recession.
Right. You and I might as well be lined up to hit the door of the plane anyways. Parachute or no parachute.
Right.
I mean, that's the problem, Kevin, is that with zero interest rates today, we have nowhere to go. We have nothing to do to solve our fiscal problems except print more money.
Now, we can do that. David, we talked about this last week. We can do that as long as the world accepts the dollar and says the dollar has strength. And we talked about the Saudi royal family last week. We talked about how we may be seeing certain things jeopardized with the, you know, discontent that's going on with the youth over in the Middle East.
Yeah, treasury and dollar security. When you think of the treasury market, you're thinking about stability and interest rates. We've talked about what it takes for there to be a yen carry trade that's successful. We've talked about the risk variables, interest rates, the currency denomination. You don't want to see extreme increases or decreases necessarily. We've talked about what you're investing in on the other side. That needs to be something of stable value, or you need to be winning in your bets. Kevin, what we've seen happen is a deterioration in the infrastructure for our treasury market. Not only are the Chinese and Japanese not buying what they used to, but the reasons why the Middle East, another huge component in the purchasing structure of our treasuries, they're not buying either because we're not delivering the goods. We're not providing the safety infrastructure that they need to maintain their regimes. So you've got the Saudi king. This is fascinating, Kevin. Just this last week, he, in desperation, is hiring 60,000 young males.
In a day.
And he's putting them into military service. This is, frankly, Kevin, not unlike the Chinese. Hmm. If you have too much testosterone for there to be political stability, you hire the young man and you put him to work, digging ditches, marching in circles, under the guise of serving their country.
Gaddafi was just behind the curve.
He needed to increase the size of his military.
Yeah.
The Chinese aren't trying to take over the world with having that many people in the military. Their one-child policy has created a demographic nightmare. We've got too many guys and too much testosterone. What do you do with an 18 to 24-year-old who thinks he's right about everything and invincible?
Well, don't you think the Saudis are basically looking at what's going on in all these other countries, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and they're going, you know what, we've got the money right now.
Let's put these guys to work. Go dig a ditch in the sand. We're going to give you benefits for doing it. We're going to take care of your family. I mean, this is desperation in the Middle East, Kevin. Just to wrap up, there's some things that here in the States we should keep in mind too, because it's not as if we have a recovery here. And we need there to be a recovery here.
Right.
We're hoping for a recovery. The monetary mandarins, the folks on CNBC, are certainly calling this a recovery. And yet, just this last week, Kevin, we had, since these numbers have been kept, since the home start numbers have been kept starting in 1965, the lowest numbers on record.
For new home starts.
So we do have a creation of liquidity. It is going into the financial houses in the United States. the bank lending mechanism is broken. Why? Because banks make their money doing two primary things: servicing the consumer for consumption purposes, right, and servicing the consumer for real estate purposes. You want to own a home? No problem. We'll finance it for you. Your local bank is dependent on those two things. And if you don't need the money, if you're not buying a new home, if you're not willing to re-leverage your balance sheet, then guess what? Bank lending ain't happening.
Well, you know, then that brings up another point. We're talking about new home starts. Those are new loans. What about the ones that already exist?
April starts a whole new round of resets for your adjustable rate mortgages. That's frankly not going to be a very big deal in this environment.
Because interest rates are still low.
But you typically don't get the benefit of rates dropping either. You've got an infinite, your rates in terms of payment on ARMs have an infinite upside, but they usually cap the downside. If it's at a 7%, if it's at a 6%, if it's at a 5%, they've tried to cover themselves so that if you go into a low interest rate environment, they have, you know, a basement level return for their investors.
Well, how about equity in housing? Because that's the one thing that keeps a person in their house is, I mean, other than just loving where you live, equity in the home is what the bank knows is the Velcro that keeps you there.
Well, I think this is, Kevin, one of the things where we're seeing sort of a dual wealth effect, and they're working in opposite directions. Most people in America have most of their assets in a home, not in a stock portfolio.
Right.
In the fourth quarter, we saw $650 billion in equity evaporate in U.S. real estate.
Hmm.
So the housing market is now about $6.4 trillion in equity, down from just over $7 trillion in equity.
So it's still falling.
This is the issue, Kevin. We've seen on the other side, as a result of QE2, we've seen the stock market pop. You look at the numbers from November today, and it's impressive. The problem is that doesn't help most Americans, because most Americans aren't sitting with $3 million in equities. They're sitting with a couple hundred grand or maybe 50 grand in home value equity, and it's gone. They didn't have the asset side appreciating on the other side of their balance sheet. They're just seeing the one asset that they own diminish.
Well, we've talked about the stock market not necessarily being a monitor as to whether you're recovering or not, because with the bailout money, where else is it going to go?
Exactly. And again, Kevin, you come back to the two issues. A zero interest rate environment sets up a carry trade, like we've had in Japan for 20 years, like we currently have here in the United States. But a carry trade sets you up for misallocation of capital and speculation with that capital. In addition to that, Kevin, not only do we have low interest rates, but we've got ample liquidity that's been provided. So you're actually doubling up in terms of the misallocation of capital and the bubble dynamics. These are things that are going to get unwound here in the next 6 to 12 months, in our opinion. And it makes a lot of sense for people to lower their risk profile as much as possible. This is an environment where people want to get as conservative as possible in their investing, even exit equities to the largest extent possible today.
David, with so many risk variables out there, there's a lot of moving parts, but there's a lot of confusion in the news right now. From a day-to-day basis, things are just, one day we've got the nuclear situation maybe getting better, and then all of a sudden smoke appears, and then you've got the yen appreciating, and then you've got, you know, this market rising or falling. A managed portfolio and a conservative outlook is probably very, very important as far as hedging that risk. You need someone professional who can do those kinds of hedges.
We've done that, Kevin. What we've talked about today, a lot of this has already been taken into account in our managed portfolios. But here's what any investor should keep in mind. Simply this: CNBC and the news networks follow these markets on a tick-by-tick basis.
Right.
Nothing has changed in the last 10 years in terms of the larger context. We've just gone from broke to broker.
Mm.
And I'm not talking about, you know, your stockbroker, but we were broke financially, and now we're more broke than we were before. The problems have only gotten worse, not better. The fragility in the stock market, the fragility in the financial markets, the fragility in the credit markets. We witnessed, Kevin, this last week, the same kind of thing that we saw in 2006 and 2007 at the front end of a financial crisis, which has morphed into an economic crisis, trying to hold a trade together, protecting the connected, protecting the leveraged speculators in the marketplace, Kevin, and it required a G7 intervention to do it.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. you should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.